Hey there, my name's Mark McCartney and welcome to the What is a Good Life podcast. Over the last 3 years, I've interviewed over 200 people around this question, not to prescribe a universal answer, but to help you to find and define your own answer to this question. I'm hoping the guests' curiosities, explorations, and lines of inquiry will help prompt your own inquiries into this question. While I'm also trying to share with you what I perceive to be more genuine expressions of the human experience and indeed meaningful conversations. Which brings us to this week and the 66th episode of the What is a Good Life podcast. And I'm delighted to introduce our guest, Thomas Moore. Thomas is the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Care of the Soul. Since then, he has written 30 books on matters of the soul and spirit. While his most recent book, which I'd highly recommend, is called The Eloquence of Silence. He lectures in many parts of the world and is also a psychotherapist, mainly influenced by C.G. Jung and James Hillman. His close friend for four decades. He has won many awards, including an honorary doctorate from Lesley University and the 2003 Humanitarian Award from Einstein Medical School. In this episode, Thomas shares his journey from studying 13 years to be a priest, to being a lecturer and professor, before becoming a psychotherapist and prolific and best-selling author. As he alludes to in this conversation, at each moment he made a significant change in his life. He felt fully led by his daimon, an inner guiding spirit or urge, to help him make considerable decisions with unwavering conviction. Throughout this conversation, Thomas shares many anecdotes and insights for living a more connected and aligned life with our inner wisdom and soul. There's so much to glean from this episode with regards to how we live our lives, how we make significant decisions, embrace pivotal moments, and perhaps it suggests a life philosophy that could steer you away from trying to understand every conceivable scenario before committing to your next major change. Look, I took so much from this conversation. It was a huge thrill for me to interview Thomas after reading Care of the Soul and also The Eloquence of Silence. And so I'm sure you're going to take so much from this conversation as well. And as ever, if you enjoy this conversation, please like, share, and subscribe. And be sure to share this podcast with people who you also think would enjoy it as well. And please continue to leave your lovely reviews if you're on the podcasting platforms, as I greatly appreciate your support at this stage of my podcasting journey. And if you want to check out either of those books that I've mentioned of Thomas Moore, amongst many others, please check out the notes below, as well as for means for contacting me regarding one-on-one coaching or executive coaching programs and indeed silent retreats. So having said all that, without further ado, the 66th episode of the What is a Good Life podcast. Thomas, thank you very much for joining me today. I have the very strange experience of having read one of your books all this week and now talking to the author. So I'm very grateful for your time today.
Well, I'm grateful to that for your interest and that you'd be reading the books and talking to me. That keeps me going.
Well, Thomas, as I tend to have the habit, it's to ask the question at the start of this, is there a question you're trying to answer as you move through life?
I don't think so. That's not the way I approach things. I've been working on a new book based on the writings of Henry David Thoreau. And he says at one point that you should live your life the way a willow leaf blows in the wind. And I kind of feel that way, that I let the wind blow and I try to cooperate, but I don't have plans. I don't have big questions, really. Maybe I'm not smart enough for that. I don't know, but I just don't have them. It's not the way I live.
Yeah. And in terms then of that, let's say even using that image of a willow leaf in the wind, I'm always really curious as to the mixture of almost whether it's a soul, a self-determinism, or you know, effort, letting go, a mixture of all these things. How do you kind of engage with life or dance with life maybe through this experience?
Well, I feel that the way I've done it, and it wasn't a plan, but just the way it turned out, the way I did it was when opportunities came along that were very strong and I was really deeply moved to move in a certain direction, I did. In certain major points in my life, I made some big turns, really big ones, starting when I was very young, a teenager. You know, I started early and I continued to follow rather than to figure everything out. I really didn't try to figure out what would be the best move to make. I just felt so strongly later, when I became, when I studied these things, I was very interested in what some people might call a kind of internal guidance. I use a very old word, daimon, for that, daimonic living, which means that every once in a while you get a deep urge to move in a certain direction. And I think it's important to follow that urge. And that's what I've done, even though it didn't seem like the smartest thing. That's what I've done. And I've developed now in my life a kind of philosophy that it, that includes that that approach.
You know, I read something in The Eloquence of Silence where you said that you, something to the extent that you made a real effort to be a priest, a musician, and a lecturer, and you just, you ended up being a best-selling author. Right. There's something, I guess, in the sense of like a, even like a feedback with life as well, though, right? Like, or just, you know, I think even a, an acceptance that failure isn't closure on something or an end, it's just a, it's almost like a, an invitation as well.
I think it is. It's, I like the idea of feedback. It's, you get the feedback from outside yourself. And I don't want to be silly about it and talk about some angel talk speaking in my ear. I don't mean it that way. I do mean that there's something, it seems to me, and it's been discussed by interesting people for thousands of years, that there's something almost like a muse for an artist. There's a sense of a presence or a voice or something that is not within you entirely, and yet it does come sometimes as an interior experience, but sometimes it's an exterior one. And so this is what people have talked about. For example, you know, one of the great people who talked about this was W.B. Yeats. You know, Yeats really wrote a great deal about this experience of a presence or a guest who appears, somebody who appears, not a real person, but a presence appears and gives you the sense of what to do next, and you do that. I tell you a little story, and that's not mine. My friend James Soman, who was my mentor in many ways, more a friend really, but anyway, he tells the story that when he was studying Jungian psychology in Zurich as a young man, he went to Jung's wake. Jung had died, and he went to the room where Jung's body was. And he says he carried this white lily with him when he went for, you know, just to, he just had this impulse to do that. And while he was standing there in the presence of Jung's body, he said he realized that he had to do his own work now, that he couldn't be a follower of Jung. He had to do his own work. And he left the room that night and walked out into his fate, into his life. And to me, that's a good example of what I'm talking about and what I experience. It's not a really clear message entirely, but it's strong enough to, for you to go ahead and move along. I've done that. I've made some big life decisions based on those impulses, and I think they have guided me and they've turned out to be pretty good.
But this is, you know, I don't know how it appears for you. I had an experience once before. I was supposed to start a job and it had a 40% pay increase, and it was in an industry that I knew I was kind of done with. And the weekend before I was supposed to start, I was doing a body scan or laying on the bed, and I just felt something that spoke to me. It didn't have any words. And I just said, oh, I can't do this. I'm going to have to hand in my notice on the first day. And when I've handed in my notice before, I've been nervous because I was letting somebody down, let alone doing it on the first day. Yeah. But there were no kind of nerves associated with it, even though it wasn't even a voice speaking to me. It was just, it's really hard to even kind of put into, to explain, if you get me.
I understand.
In your experience then, is that like, is it just the weight of the energy? Is this like, is there a clarity to the experience, or how would you kind of describe it?
I would say that it is, there's a certainty, a kind of certainty that is very different from weighing all the pros and cons of your decision. That's a certainty that comes from your head in a way, from your logic and so on. And that can provide a certain kind of certainty. But the certainty that comes from this guidance, I don't know what to call it, the certainty that comes from that is even stronger. So an example, I left home at 13 to study to be a priest, Catholic priest, and I continued that study for 13 years. It was quite a commitment of my life to that. And I was all for it all the way through. But I got up one morning when I was, 13 years later, I was 26. And I woke up and I was certain that I had to leave this now, that this part was over. I never thought it would ever be over, but I knew that at that time. I'm not saying it happened in just a day, but there were things that worked up to it. But that morning, there was that one morning that I was certain. And I was so certain, I went right to the person in charge. And I told him, I said, I've got to leave now. And this was really a shock because they had put so much into my being there. And I had, and my family had, and I had a huge amount of pressure to stay where I was. But I was so certain of this change that had come over me. And this other direction that was appearing, that I had no problem just telling them, I'm gone. You know, this is no longer where I am.
And when you, even if you think about that experience, like when you left and you took your first steps out of the monastery, like did you have any idea what was coming next, or like was there a
Oh, no. Yeah. No, I had no idea whatsoever. No. And it took me about 5 years to get back my life, you know, to really get back into something that made sense to me. It took quite a while. I was fishing around and wasn't certain at all where I was headed. But I was certain that I had to leave where I had been.
And in that sense then, Thomas, like are you... In those moments, then, do you still have a conviction that from what propelled you to make that decision? Like, is there, even though it may be uncertain, is there still a conviction that you're living out something, or you're living as you, let's say, in your own naturalness, or something to that effect?
I'm not sure I understand. I do feel, maybe this is what you mean, that that certainty continued. It never wavered. I never had regret for making that decision. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Just and then even with the ambiguity of the time that followed, like even through that period.
No. I never doubted my decision or felt that I did something I shouldn't have done. No, I never regretted it. Even now, I don't. Although I feel that my 13 years there doing that was very worthwhile for me. I'm very happy that I had it, but I'm also very happy that I left it exactly when I did.
And when you think of just as you've had this voice speak to you at different times, are there times in your life where you feel you've obstructed that voice coming through or resisted what's coming through?
Certainly there have been times when I didn't follow it the way I probably should have, you might say. I don't know if should is the right word, but I could have. But I don't have regrets then either, because I don't expect perfection in this. I think things worked out pretty well in the major turning points. There were minor turning points or minor major turning points that were not as clear, and I think I wish I had acted somewhat differently, but generally in these major turning points, I'm happy that I did what I did, and they were not easy because the logic and my friends, my family, they were all expecting something else, and so I had pressure. But I still followed this. And, you know, another thing I wanted to say, I don't know how important it is, but this idea of following the daimon, the that voice or urge, whatever it is, I practice it in everyday life. For example, if I leave the house to go somewhere and something tells me that I should go back to the house, I do it. Whether I do it just to build that muscle of responding. I think that if I do that in small things like that, that I will build my capacity to do it in the big things.
That's a gorgeous way of putting it. I've never heard of such a kind of a practical engagement with this kind of sense of daimon.
Yes. Yes. You know, I get, that's another thing I get from Thoreau. I don't know if you know Thoreau's work.
Yeah.
Great guy. And he, one of the things he says, a little tiny practice, he has all kinds of little practices like that. He says that when you leave your house to go for a walk, you should just go for the walk and don't stop to ask which way to go. Just go. Yeah. And I feel that that is somewhat related to what I just said about following the daimon in small things. That you can do it. You can change your style. You can decide not to live so mentally and so logically.
Just when you say that, and just to kind of, I don't know, it sounds like a lovely engagement with almost an aliveness then, because you're not plotting out 10 steps ahead. You're reacting to an impulse or an energy inside it. What do you think allows then people to, are some people predisposed to engaging with this? I know from a cultural point of view, we can point to many things, but even just on an individual level, what do you think allows some people to more clearly engage with it, I guess?
I've known people who it seems to be part of their character, of who they are, to live that way, to do things in that manner. And I guess I learned from them too, to see that they could make this a way of life. But I'd certainly, absolutely not the majority. It's just a few people that I think of who actually really lived in that manner. On the other hand, there are models in history and in literature, you know, like Zorba the Greek is one that some people follow. Because, you know, a fictional character, I don't know if you know him, but it's probably from my generation, but Zorba the Greek was a figure who was just a free person. And the key thing that he did to express his personality was this great dance, the Greek dance that he could do. And I think the other thing about it, though, is that he didn't have to plan everything. That he could live freely and decide at the moment what to do. And I think that characters like that, there are others, and maybe historical people that I might think of who lived more that way. And that gives me gives me encouragement to stay with that approach.
I think I heard in a talk by Hillman once where he almost described the pursuit, or not the pursuit, but the engagement with this as sometimes it can put you at complete odds with society or with an economic model of living. It seems like that's one of the biggest challenges, right? You, even when you mentioned there, when you left the monastery, that there was pressure from your family, even though you had absolute conviction.
Yes. I have to say, you know, just to be clear, they were very supportive to me, but I felt the pressure. It wasn't that they were giving it to me. I felt it because I didn't want to disappoint them. They had been sticking with me for 13 years in this, not living with them. I had to leave them, and that was extremely hard to do. But I felt the pressure anyway. And I think in other areas like this, I feel the pressure sometimes. To go in a certain direction, there are different pressures, social pressures, or maybe even financial pressures. I think that I expect that I'm going to have to devote myself to this way of life at times to overcome the pressures against it.
When when you're even thinking of clients, and just even when you're, you know, in even care of a soul or alluding to just some of the difficulties that people have, like, is it a, in whether it's even just expressing themselves or being an expression of themselves in life. But when you're engaging with, when you've been having conversations with clients around, like, not just, let's say, pathologically analyzing them and looking to provide a cure for something, like, I heard you kind of describe almost the engagement with myth and, like, almost looking for the dis in dysfunctional is you know, this is almost like the myth of the underworld. When did from going from the monastery then even to into some of this work, when did you start to kind of see the poetry or the myth in some of our lives and the application of that, as opposed to just a maybe a more linear line of cause and effect and interpreting what our life could be?
Yeah, I had many influences in that direction. You know, when I was in this monastery, part of my 2 years of my training was in Northern Ireland. So I lived in County Tyrone for 2 years. And I went to Dublin a lot. And in Dublin, I became a friend of the man who was the director of the National Gallery. For some strange reason, he took me under his wing. And he, at the time, was a very close friend of Samuel Beckett. And I had been reading Samuel Beckett for years. I think that Beckett opened me up beyond the literalism and the moralism of the Christianity that I was in as a monk. I mean, I fortunately joined this religious order that called the Servites, who were very intellectual and very liberal in their approach to things. And so I had an excellent education for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part. And so my years in the north of Ireland were very important for me to turn me in a direction toward poetics. And Thomas McGreevy, who was my friend in Dublin, was a writer poet, was a poet, but he was kind of a father figure for D.H. Lawrence and Yeats and many, many famous writers there. And so I was influenced. That was a turning point for me, my time there in the North. I left there. I went back to the United States a different person. And I was studying at that time with someone whose name is John Dominic Crossan, who's also Irish. And he was, he now is one of the, he is probably the most well-known and respected scholars of the New Testament. And he was my teacher. He was only a few years older than me. And Dominic opened me up to the scriptures and to the gospels as more as myth. And I began, that's when I began to open my imagination to the possibility of being much more interested in mythology and in literature. I had always been a musician, so I had that artistic side to me going on anyway. So that was, I think that was the really turning point for me. And then when I left the monastery, I went to Syracuse University after fishing around for a long time. And I had an absolutely fantastic program of study there, which was all about mythology and metaphor and poetics and not taking anything literally. That's when I met James Hillman when I was studying Jung there. And Jung also was an opening to me. Very big opening. So I had all these experiences that continually opened my mind to a more poetic way of understanding life and being in the world. I think beginning with Beckett, that's where I feel. Yeah. I have such a loyalty to him. Just yesterday I was reading his letters. And so it's it was kind of an intellectual move as well for me, or an artistic move. And all of that cemented the strong attitude in me toward the poetic. And Hillman, that is the basis of his work. So he and I got along very well, and enjoyed our friendship. And that friendship with him made this even more intense, if it could be done, more of a mythic, poetic way of looking at everything. And I lived it. I didn't just study it. I lived it, and I still do.
That sounds the distinction almost of living it and not just it being an intellectual thing. That comes across very strongly. Just out of interest, how would you even describe your relationship with Hillman? I know you were saying a slight mentor, but more of a friend. But just even how you interacted, or how did it feel? I guess almost.
I was teaching yesterday a course that I teach regularly, and I was telling my students before I got into the material, I read them a passage that I had come across in this big biography of Hillman that is out. And it was about, of course, I play kind of a role in that biography because I was with him for a long time, 38 years. And there was a quote from a letter that he had sent to me explaining or talking about our differences. And he described the fact that he saw me as a priest kind of guy. He always called me a monk with great disdain. He thought it was terrible that I had part of me. He didn't have any of that in him at all. And he said he was a Jewish intellectual and a radical trying to shake things up. And I was this monk trying to take care of people, essentially. And he didn't want anything to do with what I was doing. And I really didn't want to do what he was doing. I didn't like it. I just ate up his thoughts and ideas, and we were very close, but I didn't like his style. It wasn't for me. It wasn't my style. So there is that interesting connection with him that is both very tight, and we understood each other so well. And yet we were very different in our character and our backgrounds.
It almost has me thinking of that Hermann Hesse book, Narcissus and Goldman.
Yeah, it is like that. Yeah, exactly. That kind of a split. Only here it's between two. Yeah, it is between two people, as it was in that novel. Yeah. I think I read that when I was at in Ben Burb in County Tyrone.
Oh, really? Yeah. It's amazing, though, even just the movements then in different phases that you did, you have I know you said at times when you've moved from different, or when you felt that calling, you've thrown yourself into something. Was there always a great energy behind the initiatives that you got into then, or the things that grabbed you or that you felt pulled towards? I know you, once again, when you mentioned at the start, this leaf in the wind almost, but did it feel very natural when you came across some of these things to immerse yourself in new directions?
Yes, it did. I'll give you another example. I've write about these things, so you may have seen them. But when I was at Syracuse, I really loved it. I loved everything that I experienced there, including the professors. I became friends of several of my professors, and I admired them. And they taught me, they really helped me so much to get through, to get out of some of my innocence and become a little more tougher in my thinking. And so I thought I would like to be a professor. I thought that would be wonderful to be a professor now. I had always wanted to be a priest, but that didn't work out. So now I didn't have anything else to aim for until I saw this professorship so important. So I became a professor, and I taught at a university for seven or eight years. And I loved it. I really did love teaching there, but I could see that I didn't fit in very well. the ideas I had were not accepted by my colleagues there, and they didn't like my style. They didn't like anything about me, really, which was unusual for me because I've always gotten along very well with people. But so at the end of teaching at the university for 8 years, the chairman of the department, who was my good friend, called me in one day and he said, in total surprise to me, he said, the faculty decided not to vote you, give you tenure to stay here, keep teaching, so you're going to have to leave. And at that moment, it was a shock to me, really a shock, because this is where I had planned on spending the rest of my life. I loved it. I thought I'd keep doing this. And I thought I had followed most of the rules. I knew they didn't like me for what I did, but I thought they might get over that, you know. I didn't think it was going to be so bad, but they essentially kicked me out of there. And then I really didn't know what to do. I didn't have a clue what I was going to do. How would I make a living? I didn't have any idea. And it was immediate. That was my first thought. I'm sitting there in seconds after he tells me this. I'm thinking, what am I going to do? And he said, well, you can appeal this if you want. But when he said that, you know, that whole thing that about leaving the monastery came forward in me. And I knew that it wasn't just him. The way I would put it in my language, he wasn't speaking. There was a daimon speaking through him, right, telling me that this is time to again make another change. So when he said that, you can appeal this, I said, oh, no, I can't do that. I knew I couldn't. You don't appeal when the daimon speaks, the angel speaks. You don't do that. But I couldn't explain that to him. He wouldn't understand that. So I just said, no, I can't appeal. I'm not going to appeal anything. I'm off to in a different direction as of this second. And I didn't know what to do. But as soon as I left, I actually spent an extra year teaching just to kind of wean off the university. They allowed me that. And during that time, people started coming to me wanting psychotherapy. And I had training, so I was able to get a license to practice. So I built up a very small practice. I was making very little money, but only because I didn't want the practice to get too big. I had other things I wanted to do, writing for one. And gradually began to feel quite good having this new life. And that lasted a little longer for quite a while. And I was comfortable with it.
Do the people around you, have they, I know you were saying, and I misinterpreted it when you said you felt pressure, but that was to not let people down, not coming from other people. Even if it's friends or people around you, like, were you talking to them in this language, or did they understand you, or how would you describe it?
There are very, very few people I would speak to this way. Very few, because most people would not understand it, or they would probably twist it into something a little too, I don't know, superficial for me. So I did talk about it with Hillman. He had told me even before they fired me. Hillman told me in the middle of my work at the university, he said to me, you know, the soul doesn't survive at the university. You probably won't be able to keep your job there much longer. He told me that. And I said, well, I'm doing so pretty good so far. I think I might be able to handle it. But of course, he was right. So, but I managed to find a different life. And then the therapy was great. I love doing therapy. I continue to do it. I still do it these days. I'm still doing therapy, and I love it. But then I wrote this book based on my therapy, Care of the Soul, and that put me into a whole different world altogether. Suddenly I had people all over the world wanting me to talk to them or write for them or do something. So I became extremely busy. And that lasted probably 5 or 6 years, that activity around Care of the Soul. And it began to wane gradually. Now it's nobody knows who I am anymore. You know, so I don't, I mean, I do get, you know, I, there are people who will ask me to do things, certainly. I'm much more active than I ever expected to be. But the fact is, it's very different from those days when my book was selling like crazy.
Was that, like, what was that experience like to go through? Like, you know, you've not, like, it doesn't sound in this very egoic way. It's not like you backed yourself or something. Like, you've just responded to this diamond or this experience, this energy. But then when something like the success that you had with Care of the Soul, when that happens, is that, does that feel like a, not a justification or anything? Like, how does that kind of play out, even just on a in your mind, if you know what I mean, not even just on a feeling of life level?
It's hard to answer that question. I felt that I discovered for the first time that there's such a difference between Thomas More, the author, and Tom, the family man and friend of people, you know, just living at home. There's a big difference. So I had to come to grips with the fact that people related to this persona of who I was, and that wasn't very close to who I feel I am.
Right.
And so that was a challenge I had to deal with, these two persons, these two personalities. And also, I didn't do a great job of seeing what was going on, and I responded like to all the invitations to go places to speak. And to, in those days, it was very different from today. This was in the early 90s, so it was very different from today with the internet. We didn't have the internet, so I was flying everywhere. I was on planes constantly. And I think I just got swept away with that. And now I feel I wish I had been able to see more of what was going on. On the other hand, I don't want to demand too much of myself in that regard, because I think I got a lot from talking to so many people and having great experiences all over the world. And today I'm benefiting from it. I do it online today, but I still have my work to do, and I feel very good with that. My life has a lot of meaning from that.
In the experience when you're just relating, just, was it a very intense period then? Like, was there much, you know, and obviously the Eloquence of Silence that I'm reading, you know, almost the talking of space, windows, doors, you know, not so many engagements. Like, do you almost need to go through that experience to have the perspective of that you hold now, or how would you kind of look at it in that sense?
I think that's probably true. It wasn't very empty. Those times are not terribly empty, in the positive sense of that word. I said I didn't have regrets. If I had to do it over again, I think I would have done it differently. I would have a little more control over what was going on. One thing I was clear about, and here's Samuel Beck that comes into play again. When I began being very successful with my writing, many people asked me to create training programs and maybe create some big institution somewhere, or to do something big. And I knew some people that I met along the way who were doing work similar to mine. I mean, in the general sense of having a big audience and in the general area of spirit and soul, that kind of thing. And they were creating these things and making, I knew, millions of dollars at it. And it wasn't that I wasn't making money, I was, but they were making, like, you know, 20 times the amount of money that I was. And if you think about money, that would be, you know, I have a family, it'd be nice to have enough money to keep them going. But I knew from the very beginning, very, very beginning of that, that I wanted to be Samuel Beckett. Right. And Beckett lived alone, and he didn't give into any of those things at all. He was like really the extreme of someone who, you know, they asked him what his philosophy was. He said, nothing doing. You know, it's like, it's just, he was this very good empty person, and I admired him so much. We almost met at one point, but it didn't quite work out. I wish it had. But I thought of him, and I thought, he's my ideal. I'm going to continue being Samuel Beckett. I'm going to, I'm going to incarnate him in my life a little bit. His figure is going to be present, and I'm going to be a solitary author. I don't want to be the creator of some big system and, you know, have big followers and training programs. I'm not going to get into that. I felt I would disappear in all that. And so Beckett was my image. I remember very clearly that was my image. And that's what I can continue to do even today. Beckett is my ideal. I'm sitting here today with you. It's quiet. I'm writing my books. I do a little bit online, you know, give talks in different places, but not very often, you know, maybe once a week. And so it's pretty a good life to me. It's very quiet and empty.
Just curious, the way you mentioned how the time in the monastery, obviously, you know, you took a lot from that. It was very formative as well. You were mentioning the influence of that even on some of the conclusions you've come to around, not conclusions, but thoughts and experience you've come to around emptiness and nothing and this kind of sense. Was that like, did that always carry an influence like from life there? Or has this emerged in a very new way through your other experiences in life?
I would say that that I always had an inclination in that direction. But they have become all the many things that were sort of in their seed when I was younger have developed and become, they present themselves usually one at a time, and I'm able to cultivate them. And, you know, that's the way I write my books. I've written, I don't know, 31, 32 books now. And each of them is something that I was, it's like it was an initiation for me. I explored an idea or an image, and I really went through it and became more sophisticated about it as I studied for it and then wrote about it. So let's say like my book, Dark Nights of the Soul, which I saw as my, instead of calling it depression, I called it a dark night of the soul then. I mean, I had read The Dark Night of the Soul, the original, when I was a monk. It was a big part of my mystical or spiritual reading. So it was there in seed, but I was able, through writing the book, to be able to explore it in a way that made it something different and something more suited to me, both to talk about and to suggest to other people and to live myself. So that has happened over and over again, that the seeds were there, but they developed. And as a writer, I've been able to develop them in writing as well as in living.
The idea of, you know, even you've used the word image a few times, just curious as even Beckett as the image for what you'd like to be as a writer, even with having had considerable success and how you'd like to live out life. Can you just talk to me about the role of image perhaps in this, in a life of soul, in a life of rich experience? What role does image play in that?
Well, image is everything. Like the images that I have, I call this transference. My idea of what the psychoanalysts call transference. What they mean by it is that you go into therapy and you transfer your parental feelings and memories onto your therapist. What I mean by it is that whenever you encounter anybody, you're bringing your own stories and fantasies and images from your whole life. And some of them will be more prominent than others, and they will be influential in your relationship. You know, you and I talking today, there's transference going on. We both bring a lot of memory and ideas and maybe assumptions and things, images really, and maybe other people in mind. Isn't that interesting how when you meet somebody, you might see other people you've known in their face or in their body or something like that. So,
yeah.
And that really affects the way you relate. So that's a transference in my view. So those are images and they're absolutely essential because that's going on constantly in everything we do. And I have images. For example, one of my images that is strong in me, oddly maybe, is Thomas More of England. When I was a young man, because my name was Thomas More and I was in a Catholic school, the nuns always and the priests always told me about Thomas More. And I have studied him all my life. I've read, I don't know, every biography I can find. And I've gone to visit his home and his in London and the cell where he stayed, which is not open to the public usually. I went there. And so I've been devoted to this man. And it's complex because some people say that, well, he had Protestants killed in his time. He was a vicious man. On the other hand, he has this image of being this very humane, urbane kind of man who was very sophisticated and educated his children, especially his daughters, very, very highly, and had a great sensitivity and wrote interesting things like his Utopia. And I find that and we have some things in common. I have studied the Italian Renaissance. It was my dissertation at Syracuse. I wrote about the Italian Renaissance and their practice of magic. And I learned later that Thomas More of England was studying the same people and was translating some of these works that I was studying in my PhD. There's so many parallels between us and a sense of humor, which I've always doesn't come across in my books, but I really treasure a good sense of humor. And when I give talks, there's a lot of laughter. It's not, you know, my books don't seem to really get that, but I don't understand that. But at any rate, there's so much between us. So there's an image from history. And it's affected my life, that image of Thomas More of England. I think of him sometimes when I'm trying to decide what to do next or evaluate what's happening with me. I think of him. And that's just one image of many and it's so distant, you know, 500 years ago, you know, it's amazing that it's so strong and that the parallels are there with the name. So that's just one way images work and they can be quite powerful.
That sounds like a real close relationship that transcends time or something to
this. It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
There's just, when you mentioned the idea of humor in when you're giving talks or presentations and then your book, or then when you're writing maybe it doesn't feel the same to you. What comes to mind as to why that might be the case?
Well, part of it is that as a writer, I like the idea of being somewhat formal, artistic in my writing. I like to make a good book, and I like to write good English. You know, really with some style, I try to do that. I don't think I do it with a great deal of success, but I do it. And so I don't want my humor, which is somewhat from my youth, and it's my eternal youth. In fact, you know, and it's from that youthful side of me, and it's kind of sophomoric. It's not very adult humor. You know, it's kind of teenage humor. That kind of comes out of me. And when I give talks sometimes, I know there are times when I've been embarrassed or I've been sorry that I was so funny. that people laugh so much. I thought, well, they're coming to hear me to figure out how to deal with their really difficulties in life. And there I am. We're all laughing for an hour. You know, I don't know if that's the best way to do this. And so I'm a little bit concerned about how the humor gets away from me.
Is there something, though, I sometimes love the experience with friends if somebody says, like, we talked about something heavy, but it felt light. Like, is there, I don't know, is there something even, one thing I definitely picked up on when reading Care of the Soul is just the sheer, like, paradox of it all, or not being able to hold things too heavily, and not in the sense that you're not that people shouldn't take life seriously, but there is an almost an inbuilt humor to, if we don't look at it, or if we don't hold things a little bit lightly, that this life can become, we're almost too in resistance to the experience of life if we're holding things too tightly.
Yes, I think that's true. So I really appreciate things like irony and wordplay and that sort of thing. And I do think that a lightness and humor can be very good. The book on emptiness, The Eloquence of Silence, has a lot of stories, I think, that are quite considerable humor in them, and I like that. I was happy to be able to get these stories in there that are kind of fun. And yet the theme, the ideas there are fairly heavy, or, you know, at least they're serious. So I really like that combination of the two, and I think that came through in that book. Also, I published a book that very few people know about called The Guru of Golf, which is a collection of 18 stories that came to me on a golf course.
Right.
I used to play golf. Now I do a little bit, but I used to play more often, and I'd walk the golf course, and these stories came to me, and I go home and write them out. And they were all pretty funny, I thought. I mean, I laugh at them, and I have a good time with them. And but yet at the same time, they're not heavy moral stories, but they are stories that have a point about life at the same time. So I like the combination of humor and seriousness. I like that very, very much. But I don't think you would find too many people saying that a lot of my books are funny. They're not. But the humor is still there behind it.
Yeah, I think anything with Nasruddin in it is always it's always going to get some chuckles out of me for sure. Anyhow,
definitely.
Just on that though, even with The Eloquence of Silence, when I was reading it in the latter part of last week and this week, there is you're pointing to quite serious things. It definitely doesn't feel in a cynical way or a heavy or a judgmental way, but even just the absence of emptiness in the way that we speak to each other. And there's one thing that you noted at one point, which I found really interesting, and it did make me think as well for a moment. It's amazing that society in some ways operates as well as it does, given the lack of, or, you know, you labeled it not the lack of emptiness, but even the term vacancy, in terms of how a lot of people engage with each other, even with their partners and their family members, let alone on a societal or institutional level with, you know, financiers or politicians or whatever it may be. That's something, like, are you sometimes a little aghast at society as to, like, what are we doing to ourselves, or our proclivity to kind of hide from perhaps a truth of some sort?
We just don't understand the subtle aspects of life. We're not very subtle. The society tends to be very, very literalistic about everything and factual. That's what drives me crazy. I think that's the thing that is going to undo us ultimately, is that we have surrendered to fact, to measurements and to quantifications. And I mean, I have writers coming to me asking me for some suggestions for their writing. And some of them are, they have all this research they do that's quantified research. And I tell them, why don't you try writing just from your own experience and from your heart and from your own thoughts, your thoughts about things, and skip the all the studies. And they say, but then I have no foundation for what I'm saying. I don't have these studies to prove my point. And I say, you don't have to prove your point. You know, it's like that's where we are in the society, and that's a lack of emptiness, because the emptiness we need is to be able to free fall with our ideas, not to have to prove everything we say and win over, be competitive in every respect and win over everyone else. That's killing us, to being so competitive and having to control and exercise power. Those things, when you finally, I think, discover emptiness as a spiritual thing, you discover that that's so important that it liberates you from having to get caught up in all these things that are part of modern life. Modernism, or the modern life, does not see the value of any of these empty issues. So I think it's extremely important. Yes, absolutely. And I try to live that myself by not giving my work more importance than I think it deserves, and by making an effort to pull the rug out from under it rather than trying to say how important it is. I never say this is important for anybody, all this work. It's not important. It just is. It's just there. And some people will come across it and it'll be meaningful to them. Some people will come across it and just turn away from it and find nothing there, which is fine. That's just the way life is, and it ought to be. I don't want to spend my time going around trying to convince people that my thoughts are important. They're not. And I really believe that. And I think that's your life of emptiness.
there's something, I don't know, there's something hugely important, I think, that even just in terms of how we relate to other people then as well, not even, let's say, with a platform or the number of books that you put out and things like that, just even when we're relating to like people close to in our lives, that conversations could be collaborative, or that even when you have different opinions, even just like how you referenced with yourself and Hillman, there's still a great like respect or connection, that even though you see that you don't have to view things the exact same way. And right. And I think that's, you're right, like in modern society, that's, I think, what's making it harder for us to have actual conversations, or we're getting so polarized. Look, I'm just looking at the time, Thomas, and just given what you've been sharing over the course of the conversation, and just following this diamond, this energy, this sometimes calling in life, the willingness to follow that in terms of turning sharply, sometimes taking paths that aren't very clear, but doing it almost with conviction, throwing yourself into the next endeavor, a humility as well to acknowledge or to start over, then also even in the way that you're talking about your work, and that, you know, your ideas don't have to be considered this important. Then the valuing of silence, the valuing of emptiness, and using people like Beckett or Moore as images as you go through life. Just really curious to hear your answer to the question of what is a good life for you, Thomas?
Well, the good life really is are the connections of heart, or your heart, my heart, over my life. I have had an opportunity to be close, to get to know so many wonderful people, and to have come from a very warm and excellent family. My parents are extraordinary, and I feel like I have the spirit of my father in me, very strongly, who was a teacher all his life, just a born teacher. He never stopped teaching. All day long, he was teaching somebody. And he had a good sense of humor and laughed a lot. And yet he was strong and serious about life. So I've had all these people in my life. My grandfather, my dad's dad, and this one of the basic mythological stories of my life, died saving me in a drowning accident, in a boating accident, where we both ended up in the water in a very rough lake. And he held me above the boat and saved me, and he drowned, my grandfather. So I have all of these incredible people in my life, teachers that have been remarkable, other writers that I've met that I've enjoyed being close to, even though we differed so much in our approach to things. Hillman being, you know, that friendship, very unexpected and hard to understand because we were so different from each other. I'll just tell you one thing, that one time I went to his house in the country and he invited me to go with him and join him in a hot tub. And the two of us sat in this tub of water for hours, just talking whatever came to our minds. And, you know, there are these alchemical images. Jung developed them, and Hillman was very, very knowledgeable about alchemy, and I've studied it. So we were both sitting in this tub, just like the images you see in alchemy of these figures in water, in a tub of water, like the solutio, they call it. And that's what Hillman and I were doing, sitting in this hot tub and enjoying so much in common. And yet there's such a difference between us in character and style and background, purpose, all of that so different. And yet we somehow, amid all of that, we just felt this tight connection and we laughed a lot. And so it's those heart, that moment stands out, moments of heart, of connection with people. That's really what, to me, what it's all about. And then with my children, I have two remarkable children. One, my daughter, Siobhan, who's a musician that lives in Ireland. And we're very, very close. And she's so smart and so gifted as a musician and other things, writer, painter. She's just gifted in everything. And her brother, who's my stepson, is a very gifted architect. And we're all very close. And my wife is a painter. Whenever all of us are in the house together, people, we usually refer to as sort of a creative art center right here in the house. We're all doing our work. We like being together, then we all go and do our work, which is great because a lot of places people don't understand it when you want to go off on your own to do your work, but we do. So there's this incredible love in life. That's what it is. It's of all these loving relationships that are so different from each other. It's hard to use the same word love for all of it, but it's all these different variations of that. And to me, that's the whole thing. That's the whole story. The other things fade a little bit into the background in comparison.
That's a gorgeous image, though, of you all congregating and then all separating and probably engaging with another love, right?
Yes, exactly.
Look, Thomas, thank you for all that you've shared. Thank you as well for just the books that I've been reading of yours as well. There'll be more that I'll be engaging with in the future as well. I found that there's a hell of a lot to take from them for me. So, and thank you so much for joining us here on the What is a Good Life podcast today. I've greatly enjoyed the hour with you today.
Thank you, Mark. I'm very happy to be with you. And I never get a chance to talk this way. So it's a great, wonderful experience for me. And I appreciate it very much.